Carlson v. Jess. Ms. Tripp.
Good morning. May it please the Court. I'm Assistant Attorney General Kate Lloyd Tripp, representing the respondent appellant in this habeas action, in which the state of Wisconsin is the real party in interest. The state is asking this court to reverse the decision of the district court granting Mr. Carlson habeas relief. The district court erred in a couple of ways. First of all, the district court's determination that the Court of Appeals' factual determination was unreasonable in light of the evidence is in error.
Let's start from the beginning here. I find it pretty odd that this Ozaukee County Circuit Judge did not permit the substitution of counsel in this case. There's no history by this fella of gaming the system, getting right up to the start of the trial and changing lawyers or doing something like that. And it seems like this is the trial date, it's set in stone, I'm not going to change anything, I don't care what the interests are of this defendant, is a choice of lawyer. I just don't understand it.
Well,
and this is Ozaukee County. There's no crime in Ozaukee County. Judge Sykes lives in Ozaukee County. There's three circuit judges here. I don't know how many cases they have to try. And
2-day trial.
Yeah, a 1-day trial. Or
you can get it back on the calendar in 90 days.
Yeah. Okay. Well, first of all, this is under the ADPA, right? So the decision has to be unreasonable. I'm not saying that maybe it wasn't the decision we all would have made, but whether it was unreasonable, I just don't think that that's the record.
What's the factual basis for the trial judge's conclusion that the relationship had not completely broken down when both of them said it had?
Well, I think that the trial court, though, was in the best position to evaluate whether that was a lip service statement to the standard of communication breaking down or whether there really had been a breakdown in communication. He heard from both counsel as well as Mr. Carlson about their complaints about each other, and the record shows they were communicating. I mean, the difference seemed to be about strategy. And as Mr. Kaiser testified at the post-conviction motion hearing, he didn't think that communication had broken down until Ms. Shello had filing papers to move for the substitution.
Well, that standard about, you know, disagreements about trial strategy not being sufficient for replacement of counsel applies to attempts by appointed counsel to withdraw when the defendant is trying to get new appointed counsel. I'm not sure that's the same standard for retained counsel of one's choice.
But I think it's a factor in whether or not to adjourn the trial, which is what I don't think that there's anything in the record to suggest that the trial court wouldn't have substituted counsel were it not embedded in the motion to adjourn the trial.
Well, it really boils down to adjourning the trial. This was a trial date that the judge said, oh, God, we couldn't reschedule this thing for months.
Yes, he looked at his calendar.
I know what happens in Port Washington. It just seemed to me that this case could have been put on the calendar in 30 days, 40 days, something like that.
Well, according to the trial judge, it would have been, September, October, November, December, would have been January. So whatever that is, 160 days.
You know, I think it's different if it's the morning of the trial and the state has their witnesses right there.
As opposed to the day before the trial,
yeah,
which is when it was.
Right. That's a big difference, isn't it?
Well, again, maybe if we were here on direct appeal, that would be, and I'm not suggesting that it's not a difference, but I think that on collateral review for this court to go back and try to docket manage this trial court, I don't think that that's what the ADPA allows.
How many witnesses did the state have?
I believe 2. Well, regardless of whether that was an unreasonable determination, if it were, and let's say we're outside of the realm of the ADPA and we have to look at this court's decision in Rodriguez to determine if there was an unreasonable or an adverse effect. I think that the district court decision on this, maybe it's a page long, is in error. I think that everything that Mr. Carlson has set forth has been not only speculative but completely unsupported by the record. He pays, you know, has such an expert as, there's no affidavits in the record as Rodriguez contemplated. There's nothing that's beyond the pleadings to support his assertion that Mr. Kaiser's representation, his forced representation, if you will, had an adverse effect.
Well, he put on no defense other than cross-examination, right?
Right, but under the proposed defense, that would have been allowing the previous sexual assault conviction to be admitted. And I think that it was under Michello's proposed defense. And I think that it was a really reasonable determination by counsel to want to keep that out. So other than that defense in cross-examination and Mr. Carlson's testimony, as well as his wife's testimony that she was around all the time and that this couldn't have happened, I'm not sure what other kind of defense could have been set forth.
Well, I thought what was being proposed was an examination of the victim's motives to fabricate in the context of the interviews with the victim and the social services workers and the police.
Well, first,
and you know, those sorts of defenses that
right.
we very often see in child sexual assault cases, particularly where there's been a delayed report.
Well, first of all, I don't think that there's anything in the record to support that there was any sort of nefarious interrogation or that there was anything to other than Ms. Shello's assertion that there was this motive to fabricate. I don't know where that is in the record. I don't see anything about that in state court or in federal court. And here we are on collateral review, and there still has been nothing to substantiate that assertion. So
well, that's what she was proposing to do.
But she hasn't done it, and she didn't do it at the post-conviction stage. She has not asserted.
Well, what authority would she have? She's not representing, you know, she doesn't have access to.
She's been representing Mr. Carlson since.
But she doesn't have access to the victim.
But
as
nor
his counsel
would she
in
have,
this habeas case, right?
Well, I don't know that his counsel would have had access to the victim either.
Wasn't that what the pretrial fight was about? Was what sort of access to the victim and to the victim's mental health records and to.
Right, which was denied.
The. Circumstances of the interrogation at Rawhide and where he was residing and the you know, identity and of the personnel who interviewed him and took his statements and the techniques that they used. Would
right,
she have had access to that
no,
for purposes
but
of this habeas case to make a record here?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, she suggests in her post-conviction motion that she wanted to interview other people who were familiar with Rawhide and knew their interrogation techniques. That's never been done. I don't know what would have precluded her from doing that. And I don't, if I'm understanding Your Honor, I don't understand how that would make a difference because Mr. Kaiser attempted that same road and was denied. I mean, I don't. In, under that light, I don't see how he can, Mr. Carlson can show an adverse effect if Mr. Kaiser went down that same road and met with no success. I'm not sure why Ms. Shello would have.
Well, as I understand it, Mr. Kaiser asked to see the victim's mental health records or asked to have them reviewed in camera.
Right.
And that request was denied, but I don't know what the record tells us about the balance of what Ms. Shello was proposing to do. I thought it was certain investigations that had not been performed by Mr. Kaiser.
That
is
may
there
be,
something that contradicts that?
I just don't think there's anything that supports that. I just don't think that there's anything that she's set forth in the last 6 years that has been anything other than speculation of, well, I would have done this or I would have done that. I mean, as far as the expert goes, the expert to talk about delayed reporting or the expert to talk about the interrogation techniques at Rawhide, I've never seen an affidavit from any such expert to substantiate any of her allegations that there was something to put before the court about the victims being unreliable or questioning his credibility. I guess I'll save this moment. Thanks.
Ms. Dampeska.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Ursula Tempska, and on behalf of the Shalom Group, I will speak for Mr. Carlson today. I just wanted to point out that in this case, the district court correctly ruled, as it had to, that habeas relief was due Mr. Carlson in this case. Let's keep in mind that Mr. Carlson was accused of and charged with 5 counts of raping a child, allegedly 4 to 6 years before any of these allegations resurfaced, that he was facing 300 years in the Wisconsin prison system if convicted, and that upon arraignment, trial was set about 90 days out. Mr. Carlson had an attorney who did not believe, I don't think, that Mr. Carlson had any viable defenses. Mr. Carlson did believe he had viable defenses. He wanted to present them to the jury. He very clearly clarified that he did not want to plea. He asked his attorney to follow up on certain witnesses and do some investigations. That was not done, and Mr. Carlson concluded that his version of the facts would never get to the jury with that attorney. That's why he found another attorney who would fully investigate, follow up on those witnesses, figure out, bring those witnesses in, some of them expert witnesses, and show to the jury Mr. Carlson's theory of defense, which was that the allegations were fabricated. When Mr. Carlson requested from the court an continuance and a replacement or substitution of counsel, the court said, oh, no, I'm sticking to the calendar. It's my calendar, and it is the victim that are paramount considerations. And I submit on Mr. Carlson's behalf that this is the Sixth Amendment stood on its head. This is not due process as the United States Supreme Court interpreted it. What it is myopic insistence on expeditiousness in light of totally justified requests for continuance. What the result was that Mr. Carlson was forced to be represented by an attorney who had not prepared his defense, did not bring certain witnesses, did not really present the theory of the facts that Mr. Carlson had to the jury. And as a result, Mr. Carlson was convicted and sentenced to 55 years in prison. And we do not believe that justice was either efficiently or fairly done in this case. On the contrary, Mr. Carlson's right to obviously be represented by his attorney of choice was taken away from him. His right to present witnesses in his defense was taken away from him. And his right to present theory of the case to the jury was taken away from him. And whether it harmed his defense is evident. Obviously, there was adverse effect because the evidence presented by the counsel who ended up representing Mr. Carlson was slimmer, not as diversified, and basically the counsel followed a very passive theory of defense, which was merely that the state did not or would not bear its burden of proof. While what Ms. Shello was promoting or proposing to do would be a very different active, proactive defense. What she was hoping to do was show, based on the record, where the police reports show that the victim had previously denied any wrongdoing on Mr. Carlson's behalf. She wanted to use that to challenge and impeach the reliability of the complainant. And this was, as the Court of Appeals stated clearly, a battle of reliabilities. The jury had to believe either the complainant or Mr. Carlson. The more counsel...
With regard to the victim's earlier statement to the police did come into evidence, did it not?
I believe it came into... No, it did not. Because the trial attorney decided not to bring to the jury's attention the fact that Mr. Carlson had a prior sex conviction.
That would have happened. That would have happened had that evidence come in.
That's correct. In other words, Mr. Kaiser, Mr. Carlson's attorney, fearing that this might prejudice Mr. Carlson, decided not to even go in that direction. While Ms. Shello was proposing proactively to present this information to the jury and impeach the witness with his earlier denial of any wrongdoing ever having occurred. So generally, when you look at the facts, which are important in any analysis of this situation, as we know from the Supreme Court, these analyses have to be very specifically focused on the facts and circumstances of the case. By the way, the Court of Appeals never did that in assessing how the trial court performed. The Court of Appeals did not look at the facts and circumstances of the case. The Court of Appeals merely looked at what the trial court did, how it listened to arguments, read the motions, somehow processed that information, and came out with a ruling. The first court that did anything in terms of reviewing the facts and circumstances of the case in the light of the law laid down by the Supreme Court, the first court that did that was the district court. And that court correctly identified the law. It identified the fact that the Supreme Court ruled that the right to counsel of choice is presumed and substantial. And yes, it is qualified, but it's qualified very narrowly, I may say. District court clearly recognized many different rules handed down by the United States Supreme Court regulating the discretion of the trial court in deciding whether to grant or deny a related motion for continuance and substitution in the context of a constitutional claim to counsel of choice. Namely, the district court, unlike the state courts, realized that the Supreme Court said it is not allowed to put a witness's convenience over the court's duty to enforce a constitutional right. The district court, unlike the earlier courts, recognized that the deciding court has to weigh very thoughtfully the specific reasons for the request on the one hand, and on the other hand, if there are any threats or limitations resulting from the granting of the motions to fair and efficient administration of justice. And that was the first court that did that in this case. The state courts did not do that at all. There was no weighing. There was no consideration of any actual threats or limitations that might result from granting those motions to the fair and effective administration of justice. And the district court correctly decided that the state courts in this case were guided by preference, nothing but preference, for sticking to the calendar, and not by reason or by facts, and certainly not by the law, because the United States Supreme Court did say much more about how a court should proceed in deciding those motions than just, as the appellant argues, that the court has wide discretion and that the right is qualified. If there are any questions, I'd like to address them.
Thanks. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. And on behalf of Mr. Carlson, I request that you please affirm the district court's decision.
You have 1 minute.
I just want to quickly address Your Honor's question. Mr. Kaiser had attempted to elicit the testimony from the victim that he had previously denied being sexually assaulted by Mr. Carlson, but when he did so, the state objected, and there was a small conference held, and the court determined that if Mr. Kaiser were to go down that route, it would be opening the door to the prior sexual assault. So he closed it, and he didn't get that testimony in for that, I think, reasonable strategic reason. So I guess for the reasons in my brief and what I've said here today, I ask that you reverse the decision of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you. Our thanks to both counsel.